And a very good morning to you. We are live in London. You're listening to Monocle on Sunday with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up today at Midori House in London, my guests Simon Brook and Lynn O'Donnell share their views on the week's biggest stories. Simon, what have you spotted? Good morning.
Good morning, Emma. Well, yes, the New York Times is looking at the vote last night in the US Congress and asking what it tells us about the state of the Republican Party and, of course, a possible Trump presidential election victory.
And you want to talk about polo shirts as well, apparently.
I do. Very important.
We'll be heading to India for a look at the election so far, and then we're off to Bangkok.
This is Gwen Robinson for Monocle Radio in Bangkok, and I'll be joining you shortly with an update from Thailand, including border conflict and plans to build the world's tallest building.
And Monocle's editorial director, Tyler Brulé, will join me from Marbella. It's the 21st of April, 2024. Live from London, this is Monocle on Sunday.
Live from London, this is Monocle on Sunday with Emma Nelson.
And a very good morning to you, wishing you a very happy Sunday. Let's bring in today's panellists. I'm joined by Simon Brook, freelance journalist and communications consultant, and Lynn O'Donnell, columnist for Foreign Policy magazine. Very good morning to you.
Hello.
How's the week been? I remember before we went on air, Lynn, you just said you thought that this week would never end.
Yeah, the longest week in the world. Yeah.
Why?
It felt like it just full of stuff that wasn't planned. So a lot of spontaneous things that came up and stopped me getting on with what I was supposed to get on with. And then, of course, Virgoan procrastination, which is just built into the DNA.
Was it nice stuff or was it stuff that just got in the way?
A bit of both, okay. But it all got in the way.
All right. Okay, fine. Well, let's reset for Sunday. And how about you, Simon? You've been writing an article about nightclubs, which, I mean, and with the greatest of respect.
Go
I
haven't, on.
I haven't, I haven't seen you on many dance floors recently.
Lucky you is all I can say. Yeah, it's been many years since I've tried to do that, I have to say. But yeah, I've written my first piece for a publication called MCA, which is the trade publication for the eating and drinking out industry. And yeah, nightclubs are on the skids, unfortunately. They're on in decline, so are bars. But they're being replaced by something known as competitive socialising. So this is where you go out to do things. There's an organisation called Swingers, which isn't what you think it is. It's about golf.
I believe
you can also do things like competitive axe throwing. So, yeah, that's the new thing to do for 2024.
I was thinking about this because there's a big problem here in London that the great nightclubs are dying. And,
yeah.
they're going in there. They're not going in tens and twenties. They're going in their
collapsing.
Hundreds. It's really, really strange. But I always have that slight level of impatience now with people who say, I need to be entertained. And it sort of reminds me of a small child who's like, Mummy, give me something to do because I haven't got my own imagination. I can't stand and talk for a while. Does that ring bells with anybody?
Yeah, absolutely. The need to go and do something. I find this idea of competitive axe throwing really quite... What are you practicing for?
The
next Mad Max scenario. Yeah, exactly.
What if you miss? Well, let's have no competitive axe throwing, I hope. Let's go to somewhere rather more serene. Let's go to Marbella to hear from our editorial director, Tyler Brulé. A very good morning to you, Tyler. How goes it?
Good morning, Emma. I have to say that I think nightclubs are alive and well. I haven't been looking at the numbers of how many have shut down, but if you're in this stretch of Spain, there's no shortage of out-of-home advertising, massive billboards for all kinds of places to get up to fun in the evening.
And have you been engaged in any of that fun in the evening?
I've only been here for about 2 days, but I was sort of thinking I'm having a bit of a retreat down here. And listen, if you want to sort of lose a few calories, maybe actually without drinking, maybe dance floor wouldn't be such a bad idea.
Excellent. Marvellous. Well, you could lose a bit of weight if someone throws an axe at you and you accidentally lose a leg. Right. Let's
talk.
That
is happening here. That is. If you look at the newspapers here, there's a bit of a bust up between, of course, the local government here in Marbella and Madrid as well. Madrid has sent some 30 to 50 special officers to clean things up because there was that moment over the past few years where, I think Marbella probably still is on the up in many ways, but serious crime is back. Some would argue it'd ever go away, but there's been a spate of shootings, Emma. Some 6 people shot. Since February, and now this is no axes thrown, only pistols drawn, and basically Madrid has been saying that the government is ungrateful here, that they're doing everything they can. And of course, if you are a local mayor, well, you don't want to see bodies in the street.
No, you absolutely do not. And this is something that is happening in, you know, in public places, in shopping centres during the day. And, you know, there's coverage of it saying that there is that shootings and violence are becoming normalised in Marbella. I mean, how accurate a description is that? Because from the outside, Marbella does not have that reputation. And it is, it's a major holiday destination.
Sure. I think there's many sides to this place. Of course, there has been reference. We know that this is also called the Costa del Crime. It is certainly the sunny place for shady people, and you can see it. Not that one wants to be judgmental, but it's our job to observe as journalists. And if you spend any time going on the promenade, as soon as you see someone in trackies with two pit bulls, you know they're not up to any good. And there are no shortage of dogs that are, would probably be banned on many lists all over the world, with people who should be behind bars holding on to them as well. Thankfully, they're holding on to them.
OK, so we have dogs used as weapons in Marbella. What are we? Is this the locals who are engaged in the bust-ups, or is this does this have more of an international flavour to it?
It's got more of an international flavour to it. I think that on the local side, not so much local trouble. I think the Spanish trouble on the coast is probably more in Galicia with drug running and dwarf submarines. But we can come back to that later in the summer when I'm there. No, this is Albanians shooting at each other. It's Brits, it seems. It's Swedes as well. I don't think it's sort of the worlds of Magnus and Lena shooting at each other. I might add that this probably has something to do with the criminal fringe from the south of Stockholm or Malmö or elsewhere. And of course, that is the curious thing. When we travel around Europe, of course, in holiday destinations, you do see a lot of license plates from elsewhere. But there are certain cars with certain plates from elsewhere in Europe, and you just think, again, it's sort of staring you in the face what might be, of course, funding those vehicles.
And one could wonder, well, one can only imagine what the locals are making of all this.
Well, and this is, of course, this is, as you said, this normalization of crime and brazen attacks during the day and all of these things. I don't think it's certainly not limited to Marbella. It's not limited to Spain. I think this is a problem that we're seeing in a number of places. Of course, the government locally and at a national level in Spain wants to get to grips with this. They don't want the story rippling out beyond the pages of El País and elsewhere, because of course they don't want to scare tourists away. I have to say though that at this time of year, a lot of schools, of course, going on holiday. The airport, Malaga Airport, saying that it will be a record year again, double-digit increase in the number of flights. And passengers at their highest. So, of course, listen, if there are innocent bystanders hit, and hopefully not, I would imagine that I don't think too many people are scared about this. This is largely happening in the Nueva Andalusia district of the coast. So, I think, obviously, if you're staying away from there, if you're staying away from kebab stands, then you might be all right.
Well, keep away from those dogs, and hopefully we'll see you again in one piece very shortly. So you've come to what you've just described as a perfect portrait of a violent underbelly. But you're there for a retreat to relax after what's been a supremely busy week of travel.
It has. Well, it was a very, I would say, pacey Milan. Of course, our listeners and readers will know that we sent quite a deployment of editors and commercial colleagues to the Salone del Mobile in Milan this week, which is just wrapping up now. And of course, this is the biggest jamboree of industrial design of furniture in the world. The whole, really the entire planet descends on Milan to, of course, display new sofas, new outdoor furniture. But I think the bigger topic that we've been covering as well, it really is. It's a design festival in the broadest sense of the word. And if you even have maybe some newly designed packaging for lip liner, you somehow find an excuse as a major cosmetics brand to also show up in Milan and also show your wares as well. So what used to be it was never cozy, but used to be sort of a very focused event, has become incredibly broad in terms of the number of companies that want to show off their design chops.
And what's your verdict on that expansion?
Well, listen, on one side, I think it is a little bit of the creep maybe away from fashion weeks, where we've seen everything or everyone from airlines to automobile companies to hotels wanting to co-opt fashion as a way to add some luster to their brands. And in many ways, Milan probably makes more sense. I think what's interesting, though, and this is where we have to look a little bit north to Copenhagen, we've seen the Danes do something very interesting with SIF, which is the big fashion fair and fashion exhibition in Copenhagen. You know, that has really sort of seen off many other fashion weeks. I mean, you could now argue that if you really sort of get down to it, you know, fashion weeks are really... It's Pitti in Florence, which has been a little bit on the decline. And then it's Milan, Paris. London's kind of gone away. New York's not what it used to be. But Copenhagen has sort of, you know, really come up out of nowhere. And now you also have 3 days of design. And this is in June. And what's interesting here is that I heard a number of people in Milan this year saying, actually, we're here in Milan, but we're actually not premiering anything. We're not going to show our new dining table. We're not showing our new office system. In Milan this year, we're going to take it up to Copenhagen because it is much more intimate. The city is just much easier to get around. So that's a curious one because I don't think anyone really saw that coming. And now you have two major events in reasonably close proximity as well. So I think it's going to force a bit of a rethink in Milan in terms of how focused and maybe that they have to be a little bit more singular in their view, because I think there's probably a fatigue. There's so much going on. Nevertheless, very, very exciting in terms of what the offer looks like.
And also great to be in Milan in spring. There is that natural attractiveness that it can always rely upon.
Absolutely. It was glorious every single day. It was 25, 26 degrees. I mean, Emma, you'll remember, of course, being in Zurich some weeks ago when it was delightful. We had this early, not even spring, it was this early blast of summer. I think now Zurich is hovering around 4 or 5 degrees. And we had the same thing in Milan as well. Jumped on the train from Zurich, gorgeous weather, gorgeous in Milan. But then we've seen now the other side of the Alps all over Europe. It's not quite winter, but certainly very late winter has returned.
Finally, we need to briefly touch on the issue of polo shirts. Simon, you brought in a story, haven't you? It's in the Daily Telegraph. It's your fault. You brought in a story about whether you can actually wear a polo shirt and not look like a golf cliche. Is that correct, Simon?
Yeah, exactly. I think they're probably the most versatile item of clothing you could have in many ways, aren't they? I mean, everybody has a polo shirt in their wardrobe.
I've got, I don't know.
Oh, skepticism here.
I've got two or three as well. Okay. I love them. It's the rugby shirts that I abhor.
Yeah, there's a different. Yeah, I know what you mean. Absolutely,
Tyler. You're just from the view from Marbella. You talked about the hoodies and the dogs. Obviously, there's a big golf thing going down there in Marbella. Where are we on polo shirts?
Yeah, I haven't seen the golf brigade heading out, but certainly there. But I think, Simon, one of the interesting things is can you sort of get away, without looking like a golf player? But the other thing, this is just an observation from doing a bit of a retail spin around. And of course, we all know about the boom in quiet luxury. And I was talking to one of the big CEOs from one of the major Italian groups, and he said, if you go through any American mall, he said, it's just a sea of oatmeal and white, and everyone wants to look like, of course, they're walking off a chopper from Succession. That's what's really taken the industry by storm. And if you walk by the likes of Zara, Mango, all of the fast fashion players. It's exactly that. It's just a lot of oatmeal, beige, camel, and of course, an array of polo shirts as well. So it's either sort of golf course, or you want to, of course, look like you might have stepped off a very nice yacht, also owned by shady people.
Which isn't so bad a thing. Well, I mean, the looking nice is one thing. The shady yacht is something else. Tyler, thank you very much indeed. For the first time, I think I'll ever say stay safe on your retreat. And we'll shall see you very, very soon. That was our editorial director, Tyler Brulé, in Marbella. Let's talk briefly. Well, actually, let's discuss this thing, this article in the Telegraph, Simon, about the polo shirt. Is this something that we all need to be? What is the verdict? Can you dress it like properly, or can it? Or is the polo shirt a dreadful cliché?
No, I mean, I think that the point the Telegraph piece is making is that actually it doesn't have to be a cliche. You can wear it in all kinds of different ways. I mean, they've got images here of Leonardo DiCaprio in The Wolf of Wall Street, but then they've also got catwalk shows, Miu Miu, ready to wear spring, summer 2024. And there is a very striking black woman wearing a polo shirt as well. So with it looks like a Rara skirt to me. So, yeah, I mean, versatile, but also comfortable and practical.
Simon, you have absolutely hit the fashion really nail on the head. I love comfortable and practical. I find a polo shirt very difficult for a woman.
Oh, no, not
really
at all.
Hard.
No, I think that they are comfortable, stylish.
Sounds like we're being sponsored by a polo shirt company, which we're not, of course.
Other styles are available.
But we also sound as if the most important thing is whether we feel nice in it as opposed to whether we actually look nice.
I think I feel nice and look
age,
cool.
Aren't we?
That's the ideal combination.
And I'm convinced of it.
Yeah. I struggle with them. I always have issues with the length of sleeves. If they're too short, then you can just look dumpy.
Oh, you fold up the welt, dear.
Oh, you fold up the welt.
So now you're
oh,
top
right.
tip. Yeah.
Everybody, Lynn's got it. Lynn's got the polo shirt, absolutely, Lynn.
You can have them tailor-made as well, of course, so you can decide exactly how long you want the sleeves and how big the collar.
Or knit your own.
Yeah. Exactly. Those long, dark evenings.
I'll come back to us on that, Lynn. On one of your many travels, you can just knit me a polo shirt.
Something to do on the plane.
Right. Let's turn to the subject of, well, sort of serious news now. We've got a little bit of time now to talk about this enormous vote that took place in the US House of Representatives last night. Finally, Ukraine gets its money. I mean, this was, what, 6 months in the making, Lynn?
Yeah, quite a few months. A lot of back and forth over it. And, of course, you were talking about Trump before, Simon. A lot of procrastination from him and also flip-flopping on whether or not it should go ahead. The Speaker of the House, Paul Johnson, has finally... he pulled it together on a bipartisan basis, and I think that he's probably done pretty well. He's going to keep taking flak for it, of course. But the bill that he managed to get through, he's folded quite a bit into it. I mean, it's not just about Ukraine, Taiwan, Israel. TikTok ban is in there as well, so quite cleverly done. But, yeah, I think there are a lot of happy faces over breakfast in Ukraine this morning.
Just remind us of why this thing took so long to get through. I mean, you mentioned that there was the Israel, Taiwan, Ukraine. At one point, the aid was bundled into one bill, but that wasn't going to work. So they had to split it into three.
Ukraine, Israel, aid for Gaza, aid for, military support for the Indo-Pacific, which is just shorthand or longhand, if you like, for Taiwan, basically rebutting China. There's been a lot of opposition amongst American politicians, mostly on the Republican side, to funding overseas wars and rebuffing overseas aggression because of the Trump-inspired Make America Great Again notion that money should be staying at home and that the priority is illegal immigration over the border, and that much better to keep efforts at home to make sure illegal immigration is under control. This is what a lot of... politicians call the invasion that America should be rebutting. If you want to make America great again, well, you know, let's face it, if you want to keep America great, you have to show global leadership. And I think that really what we see here having passed overnight, which will go to the Senate on Tuesday, it's still got a, you know, minor hurdle to at least before it goes to Biden's desk for signing. But this support for essentially democracy shows that sense has prevailed, if I may say.
It's an interesting moment when you suddenly realise, Simon, just how much the world depends on the United States to take the lead with this. I mean, it has been said time and time again that or suggested time and time again that Ukraine can only win this war against Russia if it has America's wholehearted support. And this is obviously something that we'll be thinking about in the next few months. And this is something that Biden said as well. It's, you know, this is America taking the lead. And then you suddenly think, well, gosh, is that, you know, is that the best way that the thing should be? And also, what about the other countries which have been accused of not stepping up, of not committing in the way that the US has struggle to get to?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously over the years we've seen a number of presidents, a number of administrations trying to withdraw and resign from the position of world policeman, haven't we? And it just never works. I mean, if you are the biggest economy in the world, if you have also the strongest sort of social power, soft power, if you like, then inevitably with that comes this responsibility. And I think what's interesting about this, the New York Times, for instance, pointing out that Trump has soft-pedaled his opposition to Ukraine in recent days. And so I think he's beginning to realise that this is something that the US has to take the lead on. And I think, obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about his comments about NATO. But one thing it has done is encourage the rest of the world, certainly Europe, to think, actually, you know, perhaps we do need to do something. So there has been this discussion about stepping up and increasing payments, you know, increasing investment in defence. And so I think a lot of people would say Trump inadvertently has done the right thing there. And the other thing that comes across from this, I think world leaders looking at Trump and working out how to manage him, assuming if he does win in November, is that with him there's, as we know, there doesn't seem to be an obvious strategy, shall we say. He's quite capricious. But one thing he does seem to understand, and this is his whole, you know, the art of the deal, the whole Trump approach to life, if you like, business, politics, whatever, is it's very transactional. So I think there's a feeling that, all right, if it's going to be about money, if it's going to be about a deal, if it's going to be about investment rather than principles and strategy, then all right, we'll meet him there and we'll do some kind of deal with him whereby he feels that America is still coming out of this in a kind of financial transactional way, in you know, to their advantage.
The transactional side is absolutely key to this, isn't it, Len? Because when we look at the way that Trump has been in the past and the way that Trump could go in the future, I mean, the New York Times has just said few issues have been more central to the former president's creed than his foreign policy isolationism, his call for Europe to raise military spending, and his foreign policy shift towards Putin.
I think that the point about NATO members stumping up the 2% that they are committed to has been fair enough, to be honest. And he did encourage quite a few. I mean, I think Germany actually did stump up. America has for a very long time paid for Europe's security. But we've also got to remember that this isn't a handing over of cash. It's a handing over of materiel. So it keeps the industrial, military-industrial complex, if you like, of America ticking along, because it is the factories, the armaments factories of the American Rust Belt, former Rust Belt, if you like, making stuff, making missiles, making bombs, making ammunition that will be sent to Ukraine. And those deliveries will probably start within the next 3 to 4 weeks. So it's employment, it's money, it is transactional, but, you know, jobs stay at home. And a lot of the votes for it would have come from constituencies where those jobs will prevail.
And the interesting thing here with Ukraine now is that we have seen so many reports about how Russia is making gains. And if those, if the US military support gets her fast enough, there is a sense that this will really make a difference.
Well, there is, yeah, a lot of reporting saying that actually the first of these weapons, this military, the benefits of this military aid could be at in the battlefield in the next few weeks. Mm. So it is quick. And I think this is obviously just come in time. I think the looking at the sort of coverage and analysis, there's a feeling this isn't going to win the war for Ukraine, but at least it's going to push away that need to come to the negotiating table, which is what they're needing to avoid. And of course, the point about a war, like politics, like so many things, it's about momentum, isn't it? If there's a feeling that Ukraine might do it, they're going to win, then it's worth investing, if you like. If it looks like they're going to lose, then do you really want to spend this money? Isn't it better thinking about a post-war negotiation, as I say? I think one thing that hasn't been discussed here and is really important as well is whether this can happen before, to sort of slow down the militarization of the Russian economy. You know, Putin is already creating this war economy. And the problem is that if it really is as well established, then where does it go? Do you know what I mean? Even if we have to have peace in Ukraine, if the whole of the Russian economy is based on militarism, on war, on conflict, then Putin is going to have to look somewhere else. So if you take the focus not just of Washington but also the Kremlin, there's a need quickly to move there to prevent that happening.
You're listening to Monocle on Sunday with me, Emma Nelson. Joining me in the studio are Simon Brook and Lynn O'Donnell. And a few moments ago, we heard from our editorial director, Tyler Brulé, who's fresh off the plane from Milan, where he'd been to Salone, and that's where we're going to go to now. The Monocle team has been speaking to designers and artists at Salone del Mobile in Milan. And Monocle's Europe editor-at-large, Ed Stocker, heard from the Italian designer Domenico Diego from the multidisciplinary design firm Otto Studio. Otto Studio's founder, Paola Navone, has collaborated with Lodes to design Oblò, a decorative pendant lamp, which launched at Milan Design Week. And Ed began by asking Domenico to tell us more about Oblò.
This year we presented with Lodes this lamp called Oblò, and the idea was to make a lamp that was not lamp, like actually like we want to have some lights around but without any objects, you know, just light. So we tried to do this lamp with a very ethereal glass, and Lodes was very good in doing that because they have this technology with LEDs that you just see like very tiny lights coming out from a tiny disc, and the decent light is a glass that, you know, can be like transparent, white or a bubble and give light to the ambience.
And Oblò means porthole in Italian, is that correct?
Yes, because we like water and we like to swim, and we know water is not very nice with electricity.
I've heard that.
But we imagine this ball like looking through an oblò underwater.
This was your Otto Studio's first collaboration with Lodes, I believe. Tell us about how this collaboration came about, because it's always interesting to hear how creatives team up.
Yeah, it always starts from a meeting, you know. I met the owner of the company and we started to talk about doing something together. And since we do a lot of interior design projects, we need lights that are nice, well done, and they're doing very good quality projects. But also, nowadays it's very important to have in the projects also thinking about the budget you have. And Lodes is very good in doing not very expensive objects, but with a very good quality. And this is not easy nowadays.
I mean, you talked about not really having a meeting, but you did meet. You're not sure where. It was in Milan, maybe. You can't remember. It was obviously memorable.
Maybe it was in Venice.
Oh, maybe in Venice. But joking aside, this week is all about that, no? Meeting people, having discussions, seeing what comes of meeting new people. You know, is that one of the things you take away and enjoy about this week? The fact that you have some encounters that are random, but that may just lead to something interesting in the future that you didn't necessarily even plan.
Yeah, that's what we like the most. I mean, we like a lot traveling, but for me, Design Week is a lot, sounds like a trip. Even if you are not taking a flight, because we live in Milano, it's like the world coming in the city. whole world. So it's like doing a trip all over the world in 1 week.
Tell me a little bit about Otto Studio, because obviously you're one of the partners there. Your area of expertise, if you like, is product design, which of course is why we're talking about Hublot. But tell me about the other things the studio does, and then I'm going to ask you about the character that is Paolo Navone, the founder. But let's hear a little bit about the studio first.
Yeah, the studio was founded actually by Paola, and we do many kinds of projects. We do interior design projects. We do textile design, we do product design, we do art direction for companies. And when we do big projects like hotels, all the departments of the studio work together to develop the project. For example, for the hotels, we do all the things from the finishing to the general concept finishing, furniture, lighting, and we design even the menu, the graphic of the menu. So we took care about everything, and it's very funny to do this interior design project, because every time it's like to write a new story, like a new thing, you know. I take care of the product design department mainly, and it's not boring, it's very funny, but you have to follow some rules. I mean, if you work for a company, for example, for Lodes, you have to look at DNA of the company, so you have to some guideline to follow, you know. So there are very different projects and the very different attitude, but at the end of the day we always try to add percentage of fun in what we're doing. It's very important.
And talking of fun, let's talk about Paola Navone. I interviewed her last year at an event that was held at your Via Tortona studio. She's a character, a bit of a legend in design circles, and the founder of Otto. What's it like, with only giving away what you're allowed to give away, what's it like working with her?
It looks like not working. It's very interesting to spend time with Paola. And the first time we met, you know, I had nothing to show her. Not a CV, not a portfolio, nothing. I was very young and, you know, I did nothing. I just liked what she did. And I came in her library and she said, but why you bring this guy here? He got nothing to show. What are you going to do here? And I said, okay, I'm done. I go. And then while I was coming out from the studio, she stopped me. Okay, start tomorrow. I like your T-shirt.
That is amazing. Anime.
This is Paola.
So true story. You were hired on the basis of the T-shirt you were wearing.
Yeah.
And luckily,
I framed the T-shirt.
Did you?
No, I'm joking.
I believed you there for a second. And last question before I let you go. Tell me a little bit about some of the projects you're working on or will be working on once the madness of this week is over. I know, as you mentioned before, the studio has its fingers in lots of different pies, but give us an idea of some of the work you've got coming up.
We have several projects in the Southeast Asia. We work a lot in Singapore, so last year we did like 6 projects in 1 year in Singapore. We are developing a new hotel in Portugal, and of course, you know, we have our long-time clients we regularly work with, designing new collection, for example Baxter or Gervasoni or many other companies about furniture and product design.
That was Domenico Diego talking to Monocle's Europe editor-at-large, Ed Stocker, at the design fair Salone del Mobile. You're listening to Monocle on Sunday with me, Emma Nelson. Now, Indians began voting in the world's largest election on Friday as Prime Minister Narendra Modi seeks an historic third term. This marked the first phase of voting, covering 102 constituencies across 21 states and territories. 6 more phases are to come before voting concludes at the beginning of June. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined now by Monocle's New Delhi correspondent Lindy Prickett to give us the details. A very good afternoon to you, Lindy.
Hello, good afternoon to you.
Good to have you with us. So tell us, what's it been like over the last few days?
Well, in India, there are so many people and so many different cultures and traditions that there's always a party somewhere, there's always a festival somewhere, and the election is just one other added into the mix. So you can definitely say there's a festive air. There's a lot of people taking selfies with ink on their finger, which is the way they show that they voted. A lot of first-time voters in this election as well. So I think there's a lot of very excited 18-year-olds to be part of the democratic process. But it is fair to say that we're looking at a potential third term for the BJP and its alliance, the NDA, if indeed they need the other alliance parties to form a majority. And so you could say that there's a little bit of ennui compared to the last few elections, where, as you said, this is the first of seven phases because it's so huge. In fact, one Indian newspaper always likes to refer to the election coverage in India as the dance of democracy, if that gives you a feeling for the mood at all. It's a massive process, and there is excitement, but just perhaps a tiny bit of voter fatigue that it's same old, same old. But like I say, there's a lot of young people who are really excited that this is their time to vote.
It's interesting, isn't it, that to many of us outside India, the logistics and the scale seem to be the biggest story, given the fact that you hear reports that some voting booths will only be accessible by boat, or someone's taking a voting booth up to an area that can only be reached by elephant. And we look at that kind of thing and we think this is the interesting bit. But ultimately, this is a huge, huge test for Indian democracy, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the population, you know, it's always easy to try and figure out what a country's problems are, right? Is it caste? Is it religious divide? But honestly, the population of this place is so overwhelming. It's, to me, amazing that anything actually gets done. And yep, people can come here and see that it's a chaotic place. But actually, when you think about the fact that an eighth of humanity is on a relatively small patch of land, it is amazing that things get done. You mentioned how remote certain areas are and how marginalized some people are. For the first time, there were people in 56 villages in the Bastar region, a very tribal region of the state of Chhattisgarh, that were able to cast their vote with booths set up in their own villages. For the first time. Also out on those islands, the Andabar and Nicobar Islands, voters belonging to tribal communities there also were able to cast a vote and apparently did come out in large numbers. It's a logistical feat. A lot of it does happen at the last minute, just like Indian weddings and Indian festivities. It kind of all seems to happen. But what's amazing is that it's all pretty relatively peaceful. I don't want to tempt fate. We have six phases to go, but so far, so good.
Politically, what are people's priorities, or can you even attempt to define that in such a diverse country?
That's absolutely a great point, but it is a developing country. So it would be fair to say that development is still pretty top of people's lists, along with employment. So in some ways, very similar to a lot of other countries or most other countries. There has been a lot made this election about the employment figures and that they're not as good as people were hoping that they would be. In fact, a very credible polling agency, or rather a think tank, the CDSC, DS rather, has come out and said that Modi hasn't delivered, and that jobs, that there aren't enough jobs. Price rises have hurt the poorest of the poor, and it's been flagged as a major concern by this think tank. And I think what's interesting to note is there are a lot of jobs, but they're not the jobs that people want, because more people are getting educated. And if you're going to invest that time and mental energy on education, you're going to expect a pretty good job at the end of it, right? And so I think that that's one of the desires is the ask, or one of the interesting things about India is the aspirations are pretty much on par with anyone else anywhere in the developed world. And even people in rural India, they want the same for their children that people in urban Delhi, or perhaps even downtown New York or the center of London, want for their kids. And so that's why employment is a big issue, as is development.
Tell us a little bit more about, as well as employment, an issue, religion. It is a huge, huge, huge issue in India, with Narendra Modi and the BJP pushing the direction of travel more towards Hinduism, and many finding it a very, very difficult situation to grapple with. And also the idea that culturally, different groups can work their lives differently according to their traditions and their ways of life. And there is that something that Narendra Modi wants to sort of change and restructure, isn't it? And some people are suggesting there's almost a secularization of society and cultures that could be on the way.
Oh, there's just, you know, there's so much to unpack there and to talk about. Yes, very culturally rich country. I think what is the most and diverse in religion, and I think one of the things that's impacting this argument so much is that for so long Hindus, my majority people, many people don't say it's a religion, it's a way of life or a philosophy of life. I think that there's a growing sense among some Hindus that they feel that they've kind of been left out as minorities have been, quote unquote, appeased. It is true that some parties really do try and woo the minority voter, particularly Muslims, but also sometimes depending on the state, of course, because every state has a different demographic. So it can be Christians up in the Northeast. But I think what's interesting about what the BJP is trying to do is they're saying, rather than divide on caste and divide Hindus on caste, which has been historically the way India has operated, even under British rule, let's unite all Hindus together. Let's unite everybody, because then we have a big, strong bloc. Now, that scares a lot of people. And there has been talk, will India turn into a Hindu Pakistan? Now, what's interesting is that has been the in the ethos for the last couple of years, but the conversation's shifting a little now. And the conversation is, hold on, let's actually look at Hinduism and at its root, what does it mean? And really, could India ever be a Hindu Pakistan? Because Hinduism is naturally a secular way of life. And I think there's a feeling among some of the intelligentsia on the right that we need to reclaim that spot. Be aware of the crazy fundamentalists who are trying to make it an exclusivist space and say, no, originally we were a secular way of life, and we invite everybody to come into our country. Call yourself Hindu and pray to Christ or Allah if you want. But in India, they say that it's a Hindu way of life. So it's a very interesting debate that's starting to shift here a little bit, and just away from the very simple Hindu versus Muslim or Hindu versus Christian or many of the other religions that are here too.
Lindy, so stay with us. I want to bring in Lynn O'Donnell, a columnist for Foreign Policy magazine and also one of our lovely panellists today. Lynn, I mean, obviously having extensively covered the culture and the life in Pakistan, when you hear what Lindy's talking about the cultural and societal transformation in India, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, India, I think, is the world's biggest Muslim country, as well as being a Hindu. So what we're hearing about is a broadly tolerant society, I think, and that's largely overlooked. Pakistan is not a tolerant society. It is very much ingrained in the fabric, the politics and the social fabric of the country, that it is Muslim, and people who are not Muslim are subjected to terrible discrimination and in some cases terrible violence as well.
Lindy, what would you say in comparing Pakistan and India and the thing that the Lynn has just described in terms of a lack of tolerance in Pakistan?
Oh yeah, that's what everybody says. We don't people here say we don't want to be a Hindu Pakistan, because the root of Hinduism is to accept all, and it could never be a Hindu Pakistan, because Pakistan treats its minorities in a way that we don't agree with here. And she's right. The biggest Muslim, it's interesting to call Muslims in India a minority when there are so many of them. It is statistically a minority of the population, but it's a huge group of people here. Many who, let's not forget, chose to be in India and not to go to Pakistan during the horrible days of partition. And there are many Pakistani Muslims who seek refuge in India because they're part of fringe Muslim sects, and they're not treated with the same sort of equality that they feel that they would get in India, as are Afghan refugees, very prevalent in India as well.
Lindy, unfortunately, time is running against us, and we're talking about people competing for their voices to be heard. At the beginning of this interview, there was someone or something making an astonishing noise in the background. Tell us, what was it?
I just knew, you know, I was about to Google the name of this bird. dang. I think there's a very noisy crow. There are also some native parrots around, but I believe it's a coil bird as well that might be making noise. But yeah, there we go. There's lots of birds in the trees right now who clearly have are fans of Monocle and want to get their voices heard.
And we are delighted for them to join us on the programme. Lindy Prickett in New Delhi, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. Now we head east out of India to Thailand to hear from our Bangkok correspondent, Gwen Robinson. A very good afternoon to you, Gwen.
Oh, sawadee ka, Emma.
I'm assuming that you're not near a tree full of crows, as we've just experienced in New Delhi.
No, but I was right next to an extremely noisy street party. So luckily they just turned the volume down because I was really wondering what to do. But I think we're safe for now.
Join them. There's only one answer.
Afterwards.
good to have you on the programme. Tell us what's happening where you are.
Well, you know, here in Bangkok, we're just at the tail end of the Songkran annual New Year holiday season, which seems to get longer every year. I mean, this year it's gone for an insane amount of time. I think about 12 days overall, although officially I think we've had about 5 or 6 days off with a sort of odd extra day somewhere along the way. And that's when people get into the streets to throw water over each other and have fun making people feel very uncomfortable. And I must say, apart from trying to steer clear of numerous people trying to douse you with cold water, what's really striking this year is how strongly tourism has been bouncing back. You know, oddly, central Bangkok does tend to empty out at this time of year because a lot of Thais sensibly head to beaches and islands for their annual holiday. But this year, I think the malls, the restaurants and bars seem to have drawn a lot of tourists. You see a lot of foreign faces. So that really reflects, I think, the new-ish government's priority to further expand tourism after the terrible time during COVID that Thailand had when tourism all but collapsed.
Indeed. I mean, COVID, I recall our conversations during that period when there were efforts by the Thai authorities to try and coax people back, but also to try and work out what to do when there were no people coming and there was no money filling the coffers. Are we in a position now that things are better?
Well, much better. I mean, seriously, they had 40 million a year just before the pandemic, and they went down to less than, I think it's like something like 400,000, I've forgotten what. But, I mean, just an astonishing plunge. But already, I think this year, Thailand has seen more than a 50% jump in foreign tourist arrivals this year alone to about 11 million, which is put them on course, at least all the authorities are predicting, for 36 million foreign tourists before the end of the year. And of course, they're targeting to exceed the 2019 level of 40 million. And, you know, who knows, they might just get there because the Thais have been very canny, putting in place all kinds of visa waiver programs and easier travel rules. But oddly, for nationalities, particularly Chinese, Saudis, Kazakhs, and more recently Indians and Taiwanese, which really has had instant effect. They've also put in place amazing number of direct flights, including to places like Phuket. I mean, there are so many flights now to Phuket from Russia, even Saudi. But oddly, for European tourists and generally Western tourists, they are still confined to the usual 30-day visa that they'll give you. But I think really these new target markets are getting a really good ride because they're getting much more than 30 days. Some are getting 70 days or 90 days.
Now, let's move to geopolitics and the fact that Myanmar is proving to be a very, very tricky neighbour.
Well, indeed. And we can come back to tourism later if you want. But, that really is an urgent and extraordinary thing going on here in Thailand. It's even more bizarre because of Songkran, but just on the country's western border with Myanmar. So that's nearly about 500 kilometres from Bangkok. I think it's possibly Thailand's worst nightmare playing out, which is that the Burmese junta right next door is bombing the strategic border trading town of Myawaddy, which is just a few hundred metres away, literally maybe 400 metres from the Thai border. And that has sent a wave of refugees into the country. At the moment, it's been about 3,500 in 48 hours, which is still quite a lot in 48 hours. And this is the second round of fighting in the last 20 days. It's the Burmese junta's attempt to retake this town, which actually fell to resistance forces around April the 11th. So these renewed attacks suddenly by the military regime, which feature heavy, heavy bombing and panicking everyone, have really sort of galvanized the population and I think really alarmed Bangkok. And this is all by the military regime that seized power in Myanmar in February 2021 and clearly is now absolutely freaked out that they're losing, because clearly resistance forces throughout the country are making astonishing gains. And this particular battle is absolutely critical. This town of Miawadi is the main overland border trading route with Thailand and has maybe about conservatively $1 billion a year worth of trade going through it in two-way trade. So it's worth a lot to both sides. And I think more important, it is the absolute link point on the strategic Asian highway that leads all the way into Thailand from right through Myanmar, through Yangon and beyond. So, you know, that at all costs, Thailand does not want to see that consumed by fighting.
Gwen, I will let you get back to your street party. That was Gwen Robinson in Bangkok. Thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to Monocle on Sunday with me, Emma Nelson. Joining me in the studio, the journalist and communications consultant Simon Brook and the columnist for Foreign Policy magazine Lynn O'Donnell. Right, we've got about 10 minutes to plough through the rest of the papers. So where are we going next? Someone mentioned Iran before we came on air, somewhere that we wanted to cover and different aspects of it as well. Simon?
Yeah, the Times here in London is looking at the situation in Iran, not just with regard to the conflict with Israel, but also sort of domestically, politically, and economically. Interesting piece by Ali Ansari, who is director of the Institute of Iranian Studies at the University of St. Andrews. And she writes in her piece in the Times today that most Iranians, she says, remained nonplussed, uninterested and underwhelmed by the attack on Israel and the defence of the returned attack by Israel. She says that people are struggling to cope with rampant inflation and a sliding currency, and they're barely paying attention to this conflict. She interesting quotes here, sort of looking at the specifics of the financial situation. The average monthly salary in Iran is the equivalent of about $172 US, and the average daily wage barely stretches for half a kilo of lamb, she says, and the price of that lamb has quadrupled in 2 years. So given that very often governments, administrations, regimes fall not because of geopolitics or because of philosophy or something, very often it's the price of the food on the supermarket shelves, I wonder whether this growing financial crisis, if you like, financial problem anyway in Iran, and the effect that it's having on ordinary people might put increased pressure on the leadership.
Lynn, your thoughts on this, given the fact that sanctions are imposed, Iran is in a geopolitical mess, but there is never any sign that dissent actually goes very far in Iran, is there?
To be honest with you, I think it's quite the opposite. I think when the regime comes under the sort of pressure that it has recently and in so-called, green revolution of a few years ago, etc., it doubles down. And I think that it entrenches its power even further and knows where to give the money and the power to the military, the mullahs, the national, the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards. And this is where the power is strengthened. And I think, yeah, wouldn't it be great if the people prevailed? But, I just can't see it, to be honest with you. I don't think there's any doubt that the regime does not have the general support of the people. You see videos from football crowds chanting against the regime's support for Hamas, for instance, but it goes nowhere.
Mm. And the Sunday Times article does highlight this quite a lot by saying early indications that messaging before the attack on Israel was falling flat, including widespread mockery of the supposed telegraphing of the attack to Israel beforehand. Then comes when the authorities swiftly issue a notice saying that anyone criticising this or defending Israel would be arrested. And it is absolutely clear the way that the Iranian authorities are playing this out.
It's the knock on the door and people fear it. The crackdown on women for being women, the hair police, as they call them. This just gives more grist to the entrenched hold on power of the regime.
So when you see these articles, it's one of those things that you wonder whether it's a narrative of hope that is not intended for an Iranian audience, is it?
Well, it could be a reassurance, I suppose, for a Western audience or hope. But you mentioned women, and I do think it's interesting, Lynn. Piece reports that Mabina Rostami, who plays for the national volleyball team, openly criticised the attack on Israel in her Instagram page, saying that she felt ashamed, and she's since been arrested. So obviously, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that I wonder if there is a sort of generation or a gender divide here, perhaps, that young women, as you say, who rebelled against the hair police, and so tragically, just less than 2 years ago, Mahsa Jina Amini was killed in custody from the morality police. We were saying before we went on air, weren't we? I'm the optimist, you're the pessimist. Mm. You're probably right, I'm afraid. But I do wonder whether, you know, there will be a sort of a generation of young women who are leading this opposition to a, let's face it, an increasingly aging, increasingly remote leadership here in Iran.
The issue of women and the presence of women is something that's very dear to your heart, isn't it, in so many ways, having travelled and reported so extensively in Afghanistan?
Yeah, but it's like hitting my head against a brick wall. The situation in Afghanistan, which is reflected to some extent in Iran, it boggles my mind that it's allowed to continue. But whereas in Iran you have the support for women and their freedom to do what they damn well please with their hair, across demographics and across genders, men support it, older men, younger men, women of all ages. In Afghanistan, women are pretty much on their own. The men seem to think that it's the women's problem that they're not allowed to work or go to school or leave their homes. And that is also reflected internationally. There are no consequences for the way the Taliban treats women in Afghanistan. And as long as there are no consequences, by which I mean acquiescence of Western governments and multilateral organisations like the United Nations, UNOCHA, whatever it might be, then that also endangers my rights wherever I may be. And that message doesn't seem to be getting through.
Finally, one subject that we were covering in the news headlines in the last couple of hours on Monocle Radio, and is something that is an interesting societal observation, which is happening in the Canary Islands. Simon, you wanted to draw our attention to the fact that yesterday there were protests, people numbering in their thousands in Tenerife, calling for the island to limit the number of tourist arrivals, to basically give the island a moment to recover, to allow the population to rest, to allow the infrastructure to rest, because the number of people who visit the Canaries each year far outnumbers the number of people who actually live there.
Yeah, and I think what I found interesting in this story, and as you say, there are the demonstrations here, according to Reuters, people holding placards reading, "People live here and we don't want to see our island die." Even though, as the Reuters reports, that the tourism industry accounts for about 35% of the GDP of the Canary Islands. I remember doing reporting on a story here a few weeks ago, whereas in Seville and the mainland, there are debates about whether to close one of the main squares and just charge people for entering it. And we also looked at the situation in Venice. So I think there's a growing realization that we're going to have to do something about mass tourism. Yes, of course, it's great to travel. It's good for the economy. You'd hope that people might travel and learn something about other cultures, possibly. But it is having a really detrimental effect on local infrastructure, local lifestyles. And we've seen, you know, again, in the last few years, in Spain, in Italy and other countries, demonstrations against the Airbnbers. I mean, it's great to have people coming to your restaurant or your bar or whatever, but if every day there's a new group living in the apartment above you, that's not much fun.
Isn't it funny? We were just talking to Gwen Robinson in Bangkok a few minutes ago and saying, you know, when we remember with COVID, people were saying, please come, please come, please come. Otherwise, our economy will just collapse and die. And now we have people saying, please don't come because our economy will collapse and die. It's a lose-lose, win-win. I don't know what it is.
Well, it's an indication of lack of forethought. I mean, you know, people might say, please don't come when their economy relies on tourism, but what else are they going to do? Venice, there's only like 90,000 Venetians living in Venice and fewer every day. There's a pharmacy in downtown Venice, if you can call it that, that keeps a ticker showing how much the and how fast the local population is falling. But they can go elsewhere, but it means that what people are going for is basically, it's like a Disneyland, a theme park. And, you know, I've got a couple of Venetian friends and they've said, well, we did it ourselves. We wanted the Dosh and we got the Dosh, but we lost our city. So you have to make the choices. I mean, you know, I live in central London. I hate tourist buses. You know, please leave.
Please spend your money.
Yeah, exactly.
The tourist bus is a funny thing because Londoners don't go on it. But every time I go past it, I think one day I'm going to go on that bus.
I do too, but I'm talking about the coaches. And I lived in Hong Kong where the streets are narrow and coaches are really out of, you know, they really are disruptive to residents. But there they were. It's a way of bringing in money. So what do you want? Do you want the money? Do you want the lifestyle? Are you able to balance it and even it out?
Is the solution perhaps less tourism but better tourism? And I remember reporting from Florence when they were struggling this, and there was a new mayor, Matteo Renzi, of course, that went on to be prime minister, but he had this idea that they would get people into the city, those people would spend a little bit more time there, get to know the city a bit better. So it was more quality than quantity.
Just get rid of the buses. I think you've hit the nail on the head. Lynn O'Donnell, thank you so much for joining us in the studio. Thank you to Simon Brook, and the warmest of thanks to my guests on the line, Gwen Robinson, Lindy Prickett and Tyler Brulé. The programme was produced in studio, engineered by Mariella Bevan. I'm Emma Nelson. Monocle on Sunday is back at the same time next week. But until then, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening and enjoy your Sunday.